Well, good morning. I believe we finished up our last page dealing with God's preparation of Joseph for the task ahead. And I hope to finish the psalm this morning. And again, what we have here is a reminder. When we're going through trials, difficulties, and that sort of thing, it is always a comfort and encouragement to look and see what God has done in the past and how He has fulfilled His promises. And that's what we have here in this psalm. And if you look, let's see, we're going to start here at verse 25. Now, remember, God often uses difficult times, tragedy, in preparation for something great He's going to be doing down the road. And we see this with the life of Joseph. We saw that last week, how his imprisonment and so forth brought about the provision to sustain Israel, to bring Israel down into the land of Egypt, and also to have them at the same time isolated from the rest of the Egyptians, to grow into a nation from 70 people to somewhere between 1.5 million and 3 million in 400 years, and yet maintain their language and maintain, at least in some way, their devotion to the Lord, to remember the Lord, to remember the promise of it that God gave to Abraham. And that's going to tie into what we see here. Look at verse 25. Now remember, we're not sure when the slavery, enslavement of the Israelites took place. But it says, back up to verse 24, He increased His people greatly, so the multiplication of the Israelites, and made them stronger than their enemies. And this is one of the things that caused the Egyptians to fret. If you have a... if you have, we see this a lot of places around the world today, and this is actually one of the major concerns for one or two generations down the road as far as Muslims in the West, that Muslim families have 5, 6, 7, 8 children. And native Western Europeans have like 1.3 or something like that. They have a very low birth rate in Western Europe. And at the present rate, by the time we get to about 2040, 2050, you're going to have a Muslim majority in a lot of Western European countries. All right. If you have a nation like the Israelites, who were producing prodigiously during the time in Egypt, and the Egyptians evidently not keeping up, that the at a certain level of a certain time, the Israelites, it says, became more powerful than the Egyptians. Now, that would be numerically. That would be numerically, but not necessarily in arms. If you have an entrenched population who's been there for a long time, they have the infrastructure, they have the position of authority in the land. When it talks about there arose a king that knew not Joseph, somewhere along the 400-year period of time, probably earlier rather than later, you had a change in dynasties in Egypt. The one either died out or was overthrown, and somebody else came in that had no historic obligation to Joseph, and therefore felt no obligation to look favorably upon the Israelites. And so, with the Israelites multiplying, with them, if given enough time, possibly gaining the upper hand in the situation, it says in verse 25, He turned. Now, look at that word "he." Who is the "he" in verse 25? God. God is the one who brought this about. God is the one who changed the circumstances so that Israel would be enslaved. Now, we'll come back to that in a moment. But it was God who turned the heart to hate His people. That the Egyptians, instead of looking with favor upon the Israelites, began to be jealous of them, to be in fear of them. And so it says they dealt subtly or craftily or with deception with His servants, and they ended up enslaving the Israelites. to bring them into subjection. We see later on that they continued to multiply. It wasn't remedying the problem. And then we get to what we see there in the opening chapter of Exodus, the casting of the male children into the Nile, just to dispose of a generation of Israelites. So God is the one that planted that in the Egyptians. Now, of course, this is dealing with the natural depravity of humanity, but God is the one who did that, who orchestrated that. He turned their heart to hate his people. Now, let's pause there for a moment. Why would God do that? Why would God do that? All right, make them uncomfortable. Make who uncomfortable? Make the Israelites uncomfortable. If you, I'll give you another Bible scenario. We have the captivity. 586 BC, Jerusalem is destroyed, and in three successive waves starting earlier than that, beginning with when Daniel was deported, the second when Ezekiel was deported, and last when we have the destruction of the city, that people were sent to Babylon. The rest of the people had been wiped out except for just a tiny group of people which went down into Egypt and eventually perished there. We see that in the book of Jeremiah. And so the people who are in captivity are there in Babylon. They are not imprisoned. They are simply in exile. And so they build houses. They start businesses. They have families. And they're there for 70 years. Anybody here have your ancestors came over here less than 70 years ago? Anybody here? Okay. In 70 years, you can have a major shift. You have a shift perhaps in language, which is what happened when they were in Babylon. They switched from Hebrew to Aramaic. And plus, if you have been there for a long time, Israel is a place of stories. Israel is a place that your grandparents talked about. But it's not a place that I've ever been to. Home is Babylon. And when Cyrus issued his decree to allow them to go back and rebuild their temple, and you look at the long list that's there several times. It's there in Ezra. It's there in Nehemiah. I think it's stated twice in one of the places. And so you have this long list of people who went there, and yet if you add them all up, it's about 40,000 people. That's a lot of people. Yeah, but that was just a small minority of the Jews. The vast majority of the Jews stayed in Babylon. Why? That was home. They were comfortable. And even when we get to the New Testament era, there was a huge Jewish population in Babylon still. Huge. When we read 1 Peter and he talks about Babylon, a lot of people think that's a cryptic reference to Rome. I'm inclined to think that Babylon means Babylon. Since Peter was the apostle to the Jews, he went to a large Jewish population to minister to them. Where was a large Jewish population? Babylon. And so he went there at least as part of his traveling ministry to make them uncomfortable, to make them willing to leave. All right, we can roll this over into our own situation, apply this here at Grace Baptist Church. You know, for 15, 16 years, we had this big, huge building to ourselves. Had this monstrous parking lot. Had our choice, for the most part, of what rooms to use and shuffle around in here. And now we're having to deal with crowds. We're having to deal with noise. We're having to deal with screaming and crying children. We're having to deal with all these other things. This is putting us out of our comfort zone. And I will tell you this, that since we have had to share the building, there has been a lot more interest in getting our own place. Which is one of the reasons, frankly, I think that that's a strong possibility that we're going to end up with our own place, simply because the Lord is putting these circumstances there to get us out of our comfort zone.
Move us out of Egypt.
Yes. A number of years ago, I did a funeral, and it was somebody that had a connection here and in another church. And there was a big crowd at the funeral. There was probably, I don't know, 150 people at the funeral, maybe more. And when I was done, and it was when we were still downtown. And so we had, it was in that auditorium, the big auditorium, in the old building. And, somebody came up to me and said, and they weren't part of Grace. They said, you guys don't need your own building. Says, you're saving a huge amount of money being able to meet in this place. You're on full time. You support missionaries. You're able to do a whole lot of things with your little group of people. You don't need your own building. If I were you, I wouldn't get my own building. Now, that was counsel that was given quite a few years ago. And at the time, it was like, you know, that's... And there's an older gentleman and a Christian. And I thought, you know, there's a lot to that. And yet now we're... Now, our circumstances have changed. We've saved up a little bit more money and we're stretched here sometimes as far as space is concerned. And God is making us uncomfortable. Being willing to move. So putting the circumstances in place so that the folks are chafing under the present circumstances. All right. That's why I think they were enslaved. And also to redefine that strong division between Israel and the Egyptians. That they were not an amalgamated people. They were very much not Egyptians. All right. So that twofold thing. Drop down to verse 26. So how is God going to remedy the situation? They've been enslaved. There's a hostility between the two groups of people. There is not going to be an amalgamation. There is not going to be an assimilation. And the Israelites are no longer friendly to the idea of staying put under the present circumstances. And so God raises up the leadership necessary to bring about the change. Look, verse 26. He sent Moses, his servant, and Aaron, whom he had chosen. So it took these two fellows. A number of years ago, we went through the life of Moses. Moses is kind of like, I view him sort of like as the Old Testament counterpart to the Apostle Paul. You have a guy whose background renders him perfect for the task. He knows the Egyptians backwards and forwards. He was raised in the lap of luxury. He was raised as in the royal family. He had the best of training. He knows how these people operate. He knows how their system works. He knows everything there is to know about the Egyptian Empire. And yet, he's banished. He spends 40 years in the wilderness. Which wilderness? The same wilderness that the Israelites are going to be wandering around for the most part. Leading sheep, knows where to find the water in a place where there isn't a whole lot of it. Knows where to graze the livestock, knows where to go. And he's been there for 40 years. He knows that area like the back of his hand. And God takes this guy who has training here and training here and sends him back to be the leader to bring the people from the place to another place, and he's been both places. You've got a guy who is perfect for the job, and he has a yielded heart. Doesn't start out that way. Chapters four and five and six in Exodus, the argument that goes back and forth between Moses and the Lord, and he keeps pitching excuses. And then the King James renders this a little awkwardly, but basically is. When God keeps pulling all of his excuses away, he finally says, can't you just send somebody else? And yet, the one of God's choosing is the perfect one for the job. He doesn't want the job, and yet he's the guy. And God just says, just do it! And Moses says, okay. And he does it, and God's choice was the perfect choice. Raising up these leaders to act as God's spokesman, and also the instruments to perform the signs and wonders. Now we go through the list. We'll drop down to, so he says, verse 27, they showed his, God's, signs among them, the Egyptians, and wonders in the land of Ham. What's the idea of the land of Ham? Shem, Ham, and Japheth? For the most part, not exclusively, where did the descendants of Ham settle? In Africa. They also settled in a few places in Arabian Peninsula and in Mesopotamia, but for the most part, they went to Africa. The Egyptians, at least at this time in their history, were descendants of Ham. By the way, Noah's three sons were not three different colors. Okay, just letting you know that they probably looked a fair bit alike. For a long time, they lived in the same general area. All right, you had one big spread out homogeneous nation until the division of languages, and then the people were spread out. So just to throw that out there. All right. So here's, we have the plagues, and it doesn't list them necessarily as they were in Egypt. It doesn't list them all. But he says he sent darkness and made it dark. They rebelled not against his word as far as the Israelites. Verse 29, he turned their waters into blood and slew their fish. Again, it's not in the chronological order. Their land brought forth frogs in abundance and into the chambers of their kings. When my son was a little guy, he would have loved that. Well, this is so cool. by the way, for the Egyptians, I mean, some of you are like, oh, that would just be so gross. And just the racket and everything. There was a lot more to that for the Egyptians. The Egyptians had all kinds of taboos about frogs. You weren't allowed to touch one. You weren't allowed to harm one. There was just a whole bunch of taboos about this. And then, once all the frogs began to die, when I was a kid, I was like my son as far as loving the creepy crawlers and stuff like that, and I'd have a frog in a jar or something like that. And when a frog gets loose in your house, you have to find the frog within a certain amount of time, otherwise he mummifies. All right? And I can remember my grandmother sweeping a dried up frog from behind the stove in the kitchen with a broom. Oh, I found your frog. the Egyptians did something very odd when all the frogs died. Instead of just leaving them where they were and they would quickly go away in that climate and so on, what did they do? They gathered them into gigantic piles. And instead of having them shrivel up, when you've got, hey, we've got a big pile over here. It's got 17 tons of frogs over here, which is probably possible. As far as, what do you have when you have a bunch of a pile of tons of dead frogs? It says the land stank. Why did they do that? Because of their taboos with frogs. They couldn't touch so they had to deal with the slaves and so on and gather these because the people couldn't touch them. This created all kinds of problems for them. So the land brought forth frogs in abundance. Verse 31, he spake, and there came diverse sorts of flies and lice in their coasts. One of the things I love about the Northwest, West Coast in general, but Northwest, is we don't have a lot of bugs. Now, so you say, I don't know, I got mosquitoes. Hey, isn't that right? Isn't that right? Oh my word! You go traipsing across South Carolina in late summer, go for a walk in the woods in late summer, especially as the sun is setting, and then my dad's area. There was a way he used to describe it, but just thick with biting insects. Deer flies, horse flies, mosquitoes, certain times of the year, no seams. I remember going for a walk in certain parts of my dad's area and it was 90 degrees. I still wore my Uncle George's bee suit to keep the horse flies off. I was sweat running down the back of my neck. I was much more comfortable than everybody else who was just in their t-shirts and jeans because I didn't get bit by the deer flies and stuff. God sent plagues of biting insects to afflict these people. And this is before screens. All right. There's no escape. There's no escape. He gave them hail for rain, flaming fire in their land. This was something that the Egyptians, some of them may have heard about, but it just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. You are dealing with a place where it doesn't rain to speak of. This is one of the reasons why Egypt is a great place for archaeology. Not only is it a place of an ancient civilization, but because it's so dry there that stuff gets preserved. And yet you're dealing with thunderstorms coming through, with hail that is substantial enough to damage crops and break. It says he smote their vines and their fig trees and break their trees of their coasts with the hail. Who was I talking to here a week or two ago about some serious hail?
Australia had a bunch of real large baseball-sized hail.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody here in the last week or so about this kind of, and smashing through windows on the cars. And you have to have, if you are dealing with, I've been in hail about that big before. You don't want to stand out in it. It's painful. But when you start getting stuff that's the size of a walnut or a handball or a tennis ball or bigger, when that comes down, yeah, that's going to break and smash things. And this was substantial enough, so it broke the branch. It smashed their trees and their vines, the woody plants. It smashed them to bits. And we know that from the account in Exodus that people who did not heed the warning, because they were given it, all these plagues, Moses announced in advance so that when it happened, they knew the cause. But they also had a warning. And it says that those that heeded Moses' warning kept their livestock and their servants inside, and those that did not left them out there. And the ones that were left out there died by the hail. Verse 34, after everything is pulverized, he spake and the locust came. And the word caterpillars in your King James is referring to what, crawling locusts. For those of you, especially you farm people or people who grew up in a little drier, we don't have a whole lot of grasshoppers around here. But in late spring, early summer, if you're walking through the field, the grasshoppers are hopping, but they're not flying. Late summer, they hop and then they fly for a little while and then drop down. But they're not flying. Why? Why don't they fly in the late spring and early summer?
There's plenty to eat.
They're more than that. They don't have any wings. They haven't grown to the... grasshoppers don't operate like a butterfly, a moth, or a beetle, where they have a little larvae and then he pupates and then turns into an adult. Grasshoppers start out looking like grasshoppers. And they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then when they reach adulthood, they grow wings. And so when you see caterpillar here in reference to the plagues, it's talking about the crawling locust that hadn't developed wings yet. But they can still crunch and munch, and they ate everything to the ground. I think I shared this before. I was looking at I think it was National Geographic or something. They had a locust plague in, I think it was Mali or Niger or something like that, and just a big, huge, vast plain. It looked like just dirt as far as the eye could see. And they had a screened area about 12 by 8 and about 2.5-3 feet high that they had put in place prior to the locust plague. And inside that box, you had grass all the way up to the top. That's what everything as far as the eye could see was like before the locust came. And now you just have this little rectangle of grass where the locust had been unable to get to it. And so just munched everything edible right to the ground. And did eat up all the herbs in their land and devoured the fruit of their ground, nothing left. He smote also, this is the last one, smote also the firstborn of their land, the chief of all their strength, the future generation of leaders and so forth. And then he says, so that's the end of the plagues. And then he says in verse 37, because now the circumstances are such that the Egyptians want to get rid of them. Not only do the Israelites want to leave, but now the Egyptians are very eager to assist in this. Before they were wanting to keep them, and they have been convinced by the Lord that it's time to get rid of these folks. And he brought them forth with silver and gold, and there was not one feeble person among the tribes. We'll end with that, but I want to mention just real quickly here. They looted the Egyptians with the Egyptians' permission. And then when God said it was time to go, It says there was not one feeble person among the tribes. Everybody was in fit condition to be able to travel. God arranged the timing and everything else so that everybody was able to go when it was time. And so God orchestrates all these circumstances, sometimes tragically, to bring about what is needful in His time. All right, and we'll finish this up next time. All right, let's close the prayer. Father, thank You so much for Your providence, the fact that You are indeed in control. And sometimes when we're in the midst of this, I suppose the Israelites had a hard time seeing the hand of God when they were enslaved. And yet, Father, it is all part of Your plan to bring them from point A to point B, to give them a will to do what You would have them to do. And Father, we ask that we would willingly do what You want us to do. Father, may we see Your hand of providence in Your dealing. And Father, when it's time, Father, may we do what You would have us to do. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.